ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. American allies and enemies alike rejected President Trump's proposal to take over Gaza. Would it also violate international law? We have an assessment in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Did progressive politics get in the way of political progressives achieving their own goals? I'm Steve Inskeep.
Enemy Martinez will hear the case for how government does indeed get in the way of progress and how it can work more smoothly. Also, is the Trump administration's plan to get tough on anti-Semitism a violation of free speech? And most of the time, it takes a little while for a new song to climb to number one on the Billboard pop music chart. Rapper Travis Scott's new song just debuted at number one. It's Thursday, February 6th. Singer Axl Rose is 63 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Amid President Trump's idea to uproot all Palestinians in Gaza while the area is rebuilt, Israel is now telling the military to take steps to relocate Palestinians from the territory that's been destroyed by Israeli bombardments. NPR's Greg Myrie has more on what people in Gaza want.
Palestinians in general, and the refugees in particular, harbor this deep fear of being displaced ever since the trauma of 1948, which they call the Nakba or the catastrophe. And Trump's comments really struck that chord. It's just hard to see how you'd ever get past such a core emotional issue. We just seen more than 15 months of a devastating war in Gaza, and very few Palestinians left during that time.
NPR's Greg Myrie reporting. Critics go slam Trump's plan, saying it would amount to the forced displacement of people, which is a crime under international law. A large crowd gathered yesterday outside the U.S. Capitol in Washington, protesting Elon Musk's efforts to shut down the U.S. Agency for International Development. NPR's Luke Garrett has more.
Crowds chanted against tech billionaire turned special government employee Elon Musk, who has called USAID a, quote, ball of worms. Musk has worked to dismantle the International Aid Agency with the support of President Donald Trump. Many at the rally were current USAID or nonprofit workers, but didn't want to give their names publicly, fearing that they'd be targeted by the Trump administration.
This is my career. I've worked in the sector for 7 years. And I'm not telling many people yet, but my first child is due in September. And I want to be able to feed my family.
USAID has announced that nearly all employees are being placed on administrative leave and that overseas personnel are directed to return within 30 days. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Nearly 350,000 Venezuelans are losing legal protections, allowing them to remain temporarily in the U.S. under a rule posted today by the Trump administration. NPR's Greg Allen has more.
Large numbers of Venezuelans migrated to Florida in recent decades, fleeing the authoritarian regimes of Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro. Ending the program means that in 2 months, hundreds of thousands of them will face possible deportation. The news has sparked an outcry among Venezuelan Americans, many of whom supported Trump for president. Republican county commissioners in Miami-Dade are among those calling on the president to reverse his decision. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said he counts Venezuelan Americans among his supporters, but he's backing Trump.
So I think President Trump is getting the law right. He's going to get control over who is in this country.
DeSantis says he believes the Biden administration abused TPS in a way that encouraged more Venezuelans to come to the U.S. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
This is NPR News. London's famous Grenfell Tower is slated to be demolished later this year. As NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London, it's a public housing complex that was gutted by a fire in 2017, killing 72 people.
It was the deadliest fire on British soil since World War II, and it exposed painful inequalities between Grenfell Tower's lower-income, mostly immigrant residents and the posh Kensington and Chelsea borough surrounding it. Last year, investigators concluded the 72 deaths from the fire could have been avoided if builders followed safety standards, if regulators had enforced them, and if firefighters had better equipment. The 24-story tower is now draped in white with a banner that reads, "Grenfell Forever in our hearts. Survivors and families of those killed say they've been told the tower will be demolished starting this summer. Many are angry, though, and want it preserved as a memorial. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Police in Pennsylvania are still trying to crack the mystery of who stole some 100,000 eggs from the back of a trailer. It happened 4 days ago, and police say no tips have come in so far. They're now looking at surveillance video and asking anyone with knowledge of the egg theft to come forward. The eggs are worth around $40,000, and that makes the crime a felony. Police aren't sure if this heist is connected to the rising price of eggs because of the bird flu. U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. Dow futures are up about 0.1%. NASDAQ futures are ahead by a fraction. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. This is decision day for millions of federal employees who find themselves at a so-called fork in the road.
That is the phrase the Trump administration put into an email telling federal workers they can stay or go. Their unions have said it's not really much of a decision, asserting that the offer that looks like a buyout really isn't.
NPR labor correspondent Andrew Hsu joins us now. Andrew, can we ballpark how many federal employees have told the administration that they're going to quit?
Yeah, well, last night we were hearing it was more than 40,000, or about 2% of the federal workforce, and growing. Now, A, remember this offer to resign by today and still keep your pay and benefits until the end of September? It's gone out to more than 2 million federal employees, including people in the VA and the FDA, the Department of Education, even the CIA. So you can imagine these numbers could climb. But that said, a lot of people seem to be wary. I met a federal employee, David Casserly, at a rally outside the Labor Department. He's worked there for 3.5 years. And I asked him if he's considered resigning, and here's what he said.
No, never. I don't know anybody who's considering taking it who wasn't already planning on retiring.
And I've also heard that people who have been fully remote and can't or don't want to comply with Trump's demand that all federal workers return to the office full time, that they are also considering taking this deal.
Okay. Now, for the federal employees who do accept, I mean, what exactly are they agreeing to?
Well, it's really hard to answer that with any precision because so many different versions of the deal have been sent out since last week. So the first email that went out 9 days ago only said that people who agree to resign now don't have to comply with the return to office orders. Many people took that to mean they'd still have to work, but they could work from home. But then soon after, the Office of Personnel Management put out an FAQ that said, no, you're not expected to work at all and you'll still get paid. And then this week, agencies sent out these sample contract agreements that changed the script again and said, actually, you do have to work through the end of February. And A, you know, these sample agreements also had a lot of legalese that said things like, by accepting this deal, you're waiving your right to any action against the government if things don't go how you expected.
Wow, so it just sounds like there's a lot of things that aren't clear, right, with all this. Now, the offer, though, Andrea, is it even legal? I mean, what could happen to federal employees who actually take it?
Well, as mentioned, you know, several unions that represent federal employees have sued, saying the offer isn't legal. They've asked a federal court in Boston to halt this whole thing until the government comes up with a policy that is lawful. And there's a hearing today at 1, so we'll know more later today. One thing that the unions have pointed out is that federal agencies are only funded through March 14th, and there's a law that says agencies can't obligate funds that Congress hasn't yet approved. So unions and attorneys have been warning those who take the offer that there's no guarantee that they'll get the money that's been promised.
For the employees who decide to stay, what happens to them?
Well, from the start, they've been told their jobs are not guaranteed, and there are going to be significant changes. Agencies are going to be downsized. There are going to be layoffs. Everyone has to come into the office. It's really reminiscent of Elon Musk's resignation offer to Twitter employees, which was also titled Fork in the Road. The message to them, you know, back then was, if you stay, you'll need to be extremely hardcore. You know, here, federal workers have been told we're going to insist on excellence and we expect you to be loyal. But there's a really big difference between this, the government, and Twitter. Federal employees take an oath to be loyal to the U.S. Constitution, not to a particular president or administration.
NPR's Andrew Hsu, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Let's take a careful look at the president's proposal for the United States to take over Gaza. He surprised allies and enemies alike this week by saying the U.S. will take ownership of the territory, remove close to 2 million residents, and redevelop it as a coastal paradise. Trump said the U.S. would do what was necessary to make this happen, including, if necessary, sending U.S. troops. And he said he was calling for this after careful thought. U.S. officials have spent the time since clarifying what they say he meant. Here is his press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, speaking yesterday at the White House.
The president has not committed to putting boots on the ground in Gaza. He has also said that the United States is not going to pay for the rebuilding of Gaza.
But Israel has already seized on the part of Trump's idea that involves removing Palestinians. You may have heard our hourly newscast saying that the Israeli defense minister told the Israeli army to prepare exit options. Is any of this legal? David Sheffer joins us next. He's the former ambassador at large for war crimes issues in the Clinton administration. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you, Steve.
Under what circumstances could Israel or the United States, for that matter, make Palestinians leave?
Well, there are two ways to do this. If the intention is to do so forcibly and coercively, then a lot of tripwires in international law appear. And I'll just quickly tick them off.
Yeah.
Non-use of force, forcible displacement of a civilian population, right of self-determination, violations of the occupation law provisions of the Geneva Fourth Convention. And then finally, the wild card in this is Hamas. If there's continued armed conflict with Hamas on the ground, that further complicates following through with this kind of plan. Now, if the plan is designed with the intention to do it peacefully and under a negotiated framework, then you can pursue these sorts of goals without hitting these tripwires under international law, but that would be a negotiated procedure as opposed to a forcible one.
Everything you mentioned is some international law, international convention, international treaties, some of which the United States is party to, others of which the United States may not be, but these are principles that have generally been followed and upheld by the United States. Am I right?
Yes, absolutely. These are rock-solid international law provisions the United States has been behind for decades.
But with this said, you said it's possible to ask people if they would like to go. One of our correspondents in the region says some Palestinians indeed would like to go because the territory is so devastated. So if people agree to it, if people embrace it, that's fine?
Well, it's more complicated than that, of course, because you have to have a negotiated resolution to this problem with the relevant parties involved, including the Palestinians, including the Arab nations, all of whom would be part of the methodology of how this would actually be conducted. You know, this whole proposal that came out a couple of days ago, it sort of demonstrated that I don't think it's gone through the normal NSC process of the deputies committee and principals committee and sort of rigorous examination of what the options are and what the pitfalls are, and then you come up with an actual proposal. It needs to go through that rigorous process, but it doesn't mean it can't be done. It's just, it has to go through that process and ensure that these tripwires in international law are not hit.
Can I ask about one thing you said there, the right of self-determination? That yes. would be the right of Palestinians to decide if they want to live in a particular Palestinian state. Is it possible to see this essentially as a maneuver to prevent that?
Oh, if it's in the context of a forcible or coercive plan, then yes, you're trying to subvert that right. But of course, a negotiated procedure would have to be respectful of the right of self-determination and determine, frankly, if there's a portion of the Palestinian population that does want to transfer out and there's a willing recipient, then fine, that's negotiated, but not otherwise.
David Sheffer, former U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues, thanks so much.
Thanks.
It would be easy to miss this with all the other news, but we ain't gonna miss it, eh? One of the kings of heavy metal has announced he's retiring from live performances.
See, there are many heavy metal kings. Of which do you speak of?
I thought there was only one. Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh.
Or him. Too many just Ozzy. He's 76 years old, almost old enough to be president, and says he's doing one last show on July 5th. And here's the big reveal. He's returning with his old band, Black Sabbath.
So enthusiastic, Steve.
Yes.
Like a metalhead.
Yeah, well, I don't know that really defines me, but I at least know that heavy metal more or less started with Black Sabbath, who put out their first two records in 1970. Second of them made them world famous. Here's Iron Man, which is a classic from that album called Paranoid.
I'm going to be doing that all day, Steve, all day.
You're welcome. But anyway, things did not end well with Black Sabbath. The band fired Ozzy in 1979. He was partying a little too hard. I mean, what does it mean when your heavy metal band says you're partying too hard? Anyway, it was heartbreaking. They all went to school together back in Birmingham, England. They were like family, we're told, but Ozzy just wasn't in the right state of mind and was shattered.
So I thought they put out more recent stuff.
Well, Ozzy did rejoin the band about 20 years ago, but it's rarely been all four original members together at the same time. And apparently that's what's supposed to happen at a concert in July, and the concert will be held where it all began, back in Birmingham.
Steve, I used to watch Ozzy on his reality TV show, The Osbournes, but last I heard he wasn't doing too well, right? Some health problems?
Yeah, this is true. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's a few years ago. He's had some trouble getting around, had to stop performing for a while. His wife Sharon told the BBC that Ozzy hasn't had a chance to say goodbye to his friends or fans, although now he will have that opportunity.
So, I mean, it's kind of a bummer, but it's also very impressive. I mean, he is 76 years old.
Yeah, playing with a metal band, wearing leather pants. At least that's what we expect. I should mention, by the way, Metallica, if you're a Metallica fan, is also playing along with Slayer and Pantera. The organizers are already calling this the greatest heavy metal show ever. And proceeds from ticket sales will support a Parkinson's charity and a children's hospital and children's hospice there in Birmingham.
I will loan you my leather pants, Steve, if you want to join in the tribute.
Thanks.
If I still had my long hair, I'd thrash it.
Exactly, but keep your pants, man.
Okay.
Keep your pants. It's NPR News!
On the next Fresh Air, writer and dominatrix Brittany Newell joins us to talk about her new novel, Softcore. It explores the underworld of San Francisco's dive bars, strip clubs, and BDSM dungeons, where tech bros, executives, and outcasts live out their fantasies. Join us. Shiny, shiny,
shiny boots of leather. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. California Governor Gavin Newsom did something revealing after his state's recent fires. He issued an executive order saying he would suspend environmental reviews and other permitting so that people could rebuild more quickly. Agencies, he said, should look for regulations that can safely be suspended or streamlined. Which raises a question. If some building regulations can safely be suspended, does California need them at all? The writer Mark Dunkelman thinks in some cases California does not.
Everyone in California acknowledges that it's just too hard to build. It's just too hard to change things.
Dunkelman has a forthcoming book called Why Nothing Works. He says governments across this country have added years to many projects, even decades, by mandating environmental reviews or permitting requirements and more. Now, Dunkelman is politically progressive. He's in favor of an environmental review. His real concern is that people living near a project or political activists or local officials, just about anybody, can use the process to object to a plan and drag it out or kill it. He says his fellow progressives are responsible. They pushed for more requirements in response to the government's building of highways in the 20th century.
There was a central figure named Robert Moses who was sort of the czar of everything on the New York City landscape, and he had power for 40 years, and he was enormously effective at building roads and tearing down neighborhoods and building up public works, much to certain people's detriment and to other people's benefit. And we awoke to that with a famous book in 1974 called The Power Broker and saw how abusive he had been. And so we've spent the last 50 years trying to prevent that sort of situation from recurring. And inadvertently, we've stopped good things from happening as well.
But isn't this good in a country with individual rights that if I own a house and I'm upset about the thing that's being built down the street, I have all these tools to object and question it?
You're absolutely right. There needs to be some sort of process. It just can't be endless. And we've swung from one extreme where folks like Robert Moses could do almost whatever they wanted without anybody being able to say anything, to another where almost any objection stops everything cold.
You've mentioned public works, but has this also affected private real estate, the housing that most of us live in?
Absolutely. That's one crisis where we have too few homes in this country. That's why prices are up on the main. It's almost impossible for someone who wants to build a big new housing development to get approval expeditiously.
Did progressives cause government to be discredited in many people's eyes by pushing for these initiatives?
You know, these were well-intentioned initiatives at the beginning. Today, it's apparent to absolutely everyone, I think, that government just doesn't work well. So if you want government to work well, which progressives should want and do want, they need to look at the actual machinery of how it works.
Are there other cases where progressive initiatives are blocked by progressive governance? Somebody wants to put up a wind farm and people protest and block it, that sort of thing.
Well, the classic example is a transmission line that would have brought clean hydropower from Canada into the New England grid, and it's still not online. Progressive efforts to protect woodlands, to protect small communities, have put up so many barriers that we are unable to harness the clean energy that's available to us.
Do you see any signs that more conservative people might be embracing the regulations because it does give them a chance to keep their neighborhood the way it is?
You see that all the time. People who claim to be against red tape, and then when someone proposes that there be some middle-income housing in their neighborhood, suddenly they're vociferously in favor of certain housing regulations or zoning regulations, or are certainly very worried about what the impacts will be on local wildlife. Absolutely. We all, every American, has some interest in preserving what they themselves have, even as they want the country to thrive. And you just can't have a system where everyone has a veto.
Mark Dunkelman is at Brown University and the author of the forthcoming book, Why Nothing Works. Thanks for the not-so-inspiring title, but I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
The Travis Scott song 4x4 just debuted atop Billboard magazine's main pop chart. Hitting number one in the first week was once considered impossible. Now it happens all the time. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music has more.
The Billboard Hot 100 dates back to August 1958, and it took almost 40 years for a song to debut at number one. Not Elvis, not the Beatles. The first was Michael Jackson's blockbuster ballad from 1995, You Are Not Alone. That was considered a great feat, but within a month, another song had joined the club, Mariah Carey's Fantasy. By the end of the year, Whitney Houston's Exhale, Shoop Shoop had debuted at number one, followed shortly thereafter by Mariah Carey again, this time her collaboration with Boyz II Men, One Sweet Day. For many years, the Billboard Hot 100 had a rule where songs had to be officially released as singles in order to chart. But in the 90s, labels began to figure out ways to use that rule to their advantage, often by delaying songs' release until they'd found an audience on the radio. Those tactics laid the groundwork for hits to debut at number one. But for a couple of decades, it still happened rarely. Today, it's open season, thanks to the way a lot of people consume music now, streaming. The number of songs debuting at number one has exploded. Just in the last 5 years, 48 more songs have joined the club, and there'd be even more than that were it not for the fact that songs are also staying at number one for longer than ever before. Travis Scott has now had 4 songs debut on top, now including 4x4. The streaming era has made the Billboard charts more volatile and more predictable, which may be the greatest feat of all. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music. Got plenty of sides, I'll be taking them out. Wanna just smoke the flame, but don't wanna hide. What's in my cup is pink, I crush my Valentine. So do you love me, babe?
This is NPR News.
President Trump has laid out a plan for the Gaza Strip, asserting that the U.S. will take ownership of the territory, but Gaza's police force is still active.
They are in every roundabout, in every junction.
What this means for the future of the Gaza Strip and the Palestinians who live there, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Federal employees have until the end of the day to accept the Trump administration's deferred resignation offer. More than 40,000 have done so thus far. That represents about 2% of the federal workforce. Those who say yes will get paid through September, though there are legal challenges underway. President Trump says he will make an announcement about the Israeli-occupied West Bank in the coming weeks. This follows his push for the U.S. to take over Gaza and relocate Palestinians living there. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf sampled some reaction from the West Bank.
Adel Abu Majd is waiting for a late-night snack at a falafel stand in downtown Ramallah. He says he's paying close attention to what Trump is saying. What Trump said about Gaza empowers Israel to do whatever they want, he says. He thinks future Israeli annexation of the West Bank, illegal under international law, but popular with several far-right Israeli ministers, could now be a real possibility. But, he says, even then, Palestinians will never leave. Muav Abed, a shopkeeper in Ramallah, also thinks Trump's comments might embolden Israel. Palestinians won't accept it, he says. It will only cause the conflict to escalate. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Ramallah.
This is NPR News from Washington. Federal health officials say they've found a variant of bird flu circulating in dairy cows. The Agriculture Department says the variant's not been seen before in animals. As NPR's Will Stone reports, the samples were collected from cattle in Nevada.
This variant of H5N1 bird flu has been circulating in wild birds. Finding it now in dairy cattle indicates the virus has spilled over yet again from wild birds into cattle. It's not clear how long it's been circulating there, but it opens up new and concerning questions. Michael Warby at the University of Arizona says the variant may be different enough from the previous one that pre-existing immunity in cattle will not be protective. And this variant is the same one that led to severe disease in a Canadian teenager and a death in Louisiana.
We don't know if this new variant, if for every person who gets infected with this one, maybe more will land in the hospital.
Warby says it will take time for scientists to figure all of this out. Will Stone, NPR News.
Honeywell says it's splitting into three independent companies. The industrial conglomerate is based in North Carolina and employs about 100,000 people. In London today, the Bank of England announced its third interest rate cut in the last 6 months, with growth in the British economy showing signs of weakness. On Wall Street moments ago, stocks opened higher. The Dow's up 63 points. The S&P is up 13. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And from Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, and supporting land conservation initiatives.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Nevada's Department of Agriculture, the State Department of Agriculture, says they found a new variant of bird flu in dairy cows. It's the latest development in one of the major public health issues now facing the Trump administration. And scientists are questioning the administration's response. NPR's Will Stone reports.
In January alone, the virus swept through more than 80 commercial poultry flocks from Ohio to Missouri to Washington State. But local public health authorities haven't heard much recently from the federal government. Lori Freeman directs the National Association of County and City Health Officials. She says the regular briefings and updates for her members came to a halt when the Trump administration took over.
We're definitely feeling a gap there and hoping that those will come back online relatively quickly.
The communications pause has made it harder for public health workers to know what's going on. But Dr. Manisha Jutani says state officials from around the country did have one meeting on H5N1 with their federal counterparts last week. Jutani leads the Connecticut Department of Public Health and is also president-elect of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. She says there's still no indication the virus is spreading between people, but some states are reminding the public to be careful because it's turning up so often in poultry and wild birds.
Overall, for me, it does feel like the tempo of what we're seeing has gone up.
The uptick in poultry infections is likely tied to bird migration, according to Dr. Megan Davis, an epidemiologist and veterinarian at Johns Hopkins. And when it comes to the spread in dairy cattle, Davis says testing needs to be easier for farmers.
It's really difficult for a producer just to know if that cow is positive, which could really help in terms of on-farm control measures.
The situation took on new urgency yesterday. It was announced a variant of H5N1 that had been circulating in wild birds turned up in dairy cattle for the first time. Michael Warby is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Arizona.
How long it's been circulating is still a big question, but it's clearly making a living in dairy cow populations.
Scientists believe the nationwide outbreak in cattle began with a spillover, most likely in late 2023. But this new finding indicates the virus has, again at some point, hopped into cattle from wild birds. And Warby says it's possible immunity built up in cattle may not protect against this new variant.
We had a much more favorable shot at getting this virus out of the cattle population. That has now just become much more difficult, complicated, and less likely.
So the question is, how widespread is it, and what does this mean for humans? Infections in dairy workers have largely been mild, but this new variant has previously caused severe illness in a Canadian teenager and a death in a Louisiana resident who caught it from birds. In both cases, the virus gained concerning mutations during their illness.
We don't know if this new variant, if for every person who gets infected with this one, maybe more will land in the hospital.
All of this will take a while to sort out, and it's happening at a time when there's already concern about lack of communication. Here's Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada.
We really haven't heard a word from the federal government about how the CDC is continuing to respond, or if they're responding at all, which makes it very, very difficult for academics, people outside the government, to contribute.
A spokesperson for the CDC tells NPR numerous communications related to critical health and safety needs have been approved and that bird flu testing data on the CDC website is being updated. Will Stone, NPR News.
The Trump administration says it's going to take a tough stance on anti-Semitism. Now, one way they're going to try and do that is by signing an executive order. That's what the president did last week, that aims to deport international students who've participated in university protests over the war in Gaza. The order has a lot of people worried that the threat of deportation is being used to censor free speech and criticism of Israel. NPR's Adrian Florido has been following this. So tell us about this executive order.
Well, the White House says that its purpose is to fight anti-Jewish hate that surged since the 2023 Hamas attack on Israel. The order says that the government will use all of its tools to punish people who've engaged in, quote, anti-Semitic harassment and violence. It orders federal agencies to explore ways to do that. And just yesterday, in fact, the new Attorney General, Pam Bondi, created a task force to prosecute anti-Semitic acts, including on college campuses. The president's order singles out last year's university protests against Israel's war in Gaza, which it says unleashed a barrage of discrimination against Jewish students. The order targets international students who participated in those protests with deportation.
Targets them. So on what grounds?
Well, here's what President Trump said in a statement about his order. To all the resident aliens who joined in the pro-jihadist protests, he said, "We will find you and we will deport you." I will also quickly cancel the student visas of all Hamas sympathizers on college campuses," end quote. The president is calling the protests themselves pro-jihadist and therefore seems to be labeling anyone who participated in the protests as pro-terrorist or pro-Hamas. Now, the executive order cites the federal law that authorizes deporting a foreign national who, quote, endorses or espouses terrorist activity. And the order also directs the Department of Homeland Security and other agencies to educate universities on that law so they can monitor their foreign students and report them to the government for possible deportation.
Let me just understand something here. So the White House wants universities to monitor students and report on their own international students.
That's what the order says. Exactly how that would work and whether universities would comply isn't clear. I reached out to some schools where students protested last year, and those schools said only that they are reviewing the order.
All right, so how are students and advocates reacting to all this?
Well, they're alarmed. Protest organizers reject accusations that their stance against Israel's war in Gaza is anti-Semitic or pro-Hamas. While some people at these protests did express anti-Semitic views, the vast majority did not. Abed Ayoub is executive director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and he says the president's order is weaponizing the threat of deportation to silence pro-Palestinian activism, and he worries it could lead to a crackdown on anyone who protests Israel.
How long before we see criminal charges against U.S. citizens? How long before we see criminal detainment against these individuals? That's the next step. That's why this should be troubling.
He thinks the order is unconstitutional, and he's in conversations about a legal challenge.
Okay, what are Jewish and pro-Israel groups saying?
Well, the response is mixed. Conservative groups like the Zionist Organization of America praised the order, saying that if evidence shows protesters have endorsed terrorism, they should be deported. The Anti-Defamation League applauded the order's commitment to fight anti-Semitism, but it said that people the government wants to deport should be afforded due process. And the head of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, a progressive group, told me that fighting anti-Semitism is critical, but she worries that this order could be used to deport wide swaths of students for their beliefs.
All right, that's NPR's Adrian Florido. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, eh?
This is NPR News.
When James Foley was taken hostage and then beheaded by ISIS terrorists, his mother was enraged the U.S. wouldn't negotiate. Then she changed that. Next time, here and now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Martinez. An Altadena couple's home survived the Eaton fire. So did the 525-pound squatter living beneath it. An adult male bear had been in the crawl space for years because a neighbor kept feeding him. Before the fire, wildlife officials would not help. But now the bear was blocking crews from turning the power on. So officials put a rotisserie chicken, sardines, and peanut butter apples in a trap. It worked. The bear was now moved to the Angeles National Forest. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Let's find out how some state authorities are trying to enforce federal immigration law. The response is different state by state. And we're going to go to Georgia, where the murder of a student led to a new national immigration law. The state of Georgia has its own law telling sheriffs to cooperate with immigration authorities, and it turns out that's hard to do. Here's Emily Wu Pearson of WABE in Atlanta.
Lakin Riley was murdered last February by a Venezuelan man who crossed the border illegally and had once been caught shoplifting but was let go. Within days, Georgia legislators made immigration enforcement a top priority.
In Georgia, the people of this state, the people we represent, are expecting us to do something.
That's Jesse Petrie, the Republican state representative who championed the Georgia law. It requires local sheriffs to apply for a 287G partnership, a federal program that deputizes local law enforcement to take on some federal immigration responsibilities inside jails, mainly to identify and detain migrants without legal status arrested on criminal charges.
The law mandates they ask to participate. The law does not mandate they participate.
Terry Norris is the executive director of the Georgia Sheriffs Association. He says they worked last year with 142 sheriffs across the state to request the 287G partnership.
We created a template, a little two-line letter to ICE saying, I'm Sheriff So-and-so from County So-and-so. Please know that I'm interested in the 287G program.
He says no county was approved for the program last year, with ICE saying the sheriffs didn't have enough resources. An ICE spokesman did not respond to a request for comment. Norris says lack of personnel was one problem.
Georgia sheriffs are like almost every other agency throughout the country. We have a very difficult time hiring deputies and jailers.
And that's one thing they'll need to comply with 287G. Norris and his association are hoping for more state funding to make that happen.
County taxpayers pay the cost of the sheriff's office, the cost for the jail, or the medical and the mental health costs, the food costs.
Several Republican-led states are now considering similar legislation that would involve local authorities in the enforcement of federal immigration laws. Some of the proposals just call for local law enforcement not to hinder federal immigration operations. Others require these federal 287G partnerships, which are not cheap, says Emily Davis, who teaches immigration law at Emory University.
It's very costly for local governments to do that sort of immigration work, and they're not typically familiar enough with immigration status and immigration law to be able to make that determination.
Enforcement of immigration law is a federal responsibility, and the National Lakin Riley Act directs authorities to detain and deport people without legal status who've been accused of a wide range of crimes, including shoplifting, burglary, assaulting a police officer, or any crime that results in the death or serious bodily injury to another person. Atlanta immigration attorney Charles Cook says that will take a lot more ICE agents.
ICE warned Congress as they were considering this bill that, one, they had neither the fund nor the resources to actually carry out this bill, and two, if they wanted that to happen, they would need approximately $23 billion.
Cook says the law without funding will not have a real effect. Meanwhile, Georgia sheriffs will try again for 287G partnerships under a new administration. For NPR News, I'm Emily Wu Pearson in Atlanta.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. In most states, freedom of information laws give people access to records from their legislature and governor's office. Not in Michigan, though. A few Democrats and Republicans there are working together to change that. Colin Jackson from the Michigan Public Radio Network reports.
Like a lot of states, Michigan has a Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA law, that lets residents look at different types of government records. Detroit community organizer Tara Brown says she's used FOIA to amass 4-inch binders worth of records. She says it's great for when she attends meetings for the state's housing agency.
Sometimes they'll mention things and I might not understand them, or I want to take a look at it further, and I'll send a FOIA request for it.
Other times, Brown, who says people call her a FOIA queen, uses it to discover things like how dozens of Detroit police officers were working without licenses.
I forwarded out to like every news organization that I could think of and every like police protesting agency that I could think of.
But Brown or others can't use FOIA to access records from state lawmakers or the governor. Past legislatures and governors applied the open records law to state agencies and local governments, but not themselves.
It's very difficult to get that information from those branches of government.
Quentin Turner directs the government accountability group Common Cause Michigan. He says stronger open records policies would let Michiganders better know what's going on.
We can see kind of behind the veil of the decision-making process and like what's influencing the decisions being made by our legislature and by our executive branch. And if we know that there's impropriety in those decisions, we can then, you know, hold them accountable.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan said a year ago that only one other state exempts both the legislature and governor's office from open records laws. But bills to change that have repeatedly died in the legislature. Turner explains why.
There's not a lot of, I think, strong desire or incentive to have the scrutiny of your work be increased.
Bills to expand FOIA tend to fall through the cracks. They passed the House a couple times and failed in the Senate. Last year, they finally passed the Senate for the first time, but died in the House. Still, this year, one of the sponsors, Republican State Senator Ed McBroom, is optimistic.
Despite all of the media negativity that I've heard coming from certain members, like they're never going to do it, I think it's finally going to happen.
And the bills passed the Senate again in January. But Republican House Speaker Matt Hall, who has backed similar bills in the past, says they won't pass the House this time, and he warns that some of the apparent support is just for show.
For 10 years, these guys have come up with sales pitch to you in the media that they're going to do this, and you guys have bought it for 10 years, okay? So I would just encourage you guys, don't get your hopes up too much, okay? They're all politicians.
And Hall says he'd rather focus on other things, like budget transparency and keeping lawmakers from becoming lobbyists immediately after leaving office. As for Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer, she voluntarily releases her financial records and believes in transparency, according to a statement from her office, but it didn't commit to the FOIA expansion. For NPR News, I'm Colin Jackson.
Okay, it's the height of hockey season, so we're going to listen to a team in Minnesota with a spirit that matches its name. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker takes on this great challenge of correct pronunciation.
Okay, listen close, because the name of this team is appropriate for public radio.
Let's go, Mother Puckers!
That's right, the Mother Puckers. Yes, with a P. There are a handful of like-minded clubs that share the name across the country. This one is based in Duluth. At a recent scrimmage at an outdoor neighborhood rink, the temperature was in the single digits, but Julie Floatin barely noticed.
I don't even pay attention to the cold. It's just like being a kid again, because you're just playing.
Floatin is 54. She's an oncology nurse in Duluth. She skated a little bit as a kid, but never played hockey. Then last year, she found the Mother Puckers.
Everyone's so welcoming, right? So, and it feels like it's rare to have a community like that as adults. People willing to learn something new and be silly and be vulnerable.
Some more experienced players fly across the ice, but others are still wobbly on their skates.
Oh!
And then two players collide and crash to the ice. They get to their knees, make sure they're okay, and then hug each other, laughing. One of them, Deanna Nataro, proudly shows off her jersey.
This is jersey number 53 because I started hockey when I was 53 years old.
This is only Nataro's fourth practice.
I'm what Mother Puckers was made for, I have a lot to work on, but it makes it challenging and fun, and I have a lot of good mentors around me.
One of whom is Kimberly Rhines, also 53.
Nobody says, you know, that you shouldn't be here or that you're not good enough. And at my age, that doesn't happen very often, where you can kind of start something from scratch, never having done it before, and still feel like you belong.
Rhines and many others are truly mothers. Many have kids who play hockey and wanted to learn the game themselves. 42-year-old Lisa Klein started the Duluth team a couple years ago after learning to play at a Mother Puckers club outside Chicago. There are professors and designers, firefighters and hairstylists. 60 members play once a week outdoors just among themselves.
I love that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Like, I can fall down and I can fail and I can get back up and it's not important. It's just pure joy. So much laughing. I think I laugh more here than at any other space in my life.
After practice, Stuart Getty lingers on the ice to cool off. They learned about the Mother Puckers in an article that said the team was open to anyone who wanted to play women's hockey.
And I use they, them pronouns. I'm non-binary. And so I reached out to them and said, I'd love to learn how to play hockey. What do you guys think? And they were like, heck yeah, we said welcome to all, so come on down. Because, like, I look real gay. And I came from California, and I was like, oh, God, they're going to hate me. And they have been amazingly inclusive.
Getty, who's 43, says a lot of their teammates wanted to play hockey when they were younger. But many were told girls couldn't play. For some who did, it got so competitive, it wasn't fun anymore.
There's just, like, all these stories of people where hockey said no to them, and this team says yes.
Which kind of sums up the Mother Puckers. They support one another while challenging themselves to do something really hard. And they have a lot of fun doing it. For NPR News, I'm Dan Crocker in Duluth.
Dan's with Minnesota Public Radio. That's MPR, also known as Mother Pucker Radio. Who knows? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Good to enunciate. I'm A. Martinez.